What was your feeling when I initially invited you to submit a proposal for the first book in the series, Studies of Play, Performance, Learning, and Development?
Well, what I recall was the first, gosh, it must have taken us a year. I can't remember how I first felt. Well, first of all, I felt honored and excited. I mean, it sounded like a great opportunity. So that's what opened the door to all this. And then you might remember that we had a long process of trying to figure out exactly what I could do that would work well in the series that you wanted to edit. And it was a struggle. But I think that when we landed on this topic of kind of the settings, the opportunity for play and performance in these activity settings for autistic youth, everything fell into place. So I guess I would say I went from being initially really excited to, I never got discouraged, but I remember just the feeling, are we ever going to get the topic down?
Yeah.
And you were very patient with me, and I appreciate that. And when we finally talked our way into this one, then, you know, once it got traction like that, then it got pretty exciting.
Yeah. How are you feeling now? Are you pleased with the book?
I very much am. And I guess this is like any book that you are learning about as you write it, which is certainly the case with me. Even at this point, when I'm supposed to be preparing the final draft, I'm continuing to read new things that I'm going back and doing little tune-ups along the way. Aaron Feinstein, you know, who's a contributor, recommended that I read a book called Neurotribes, which is really a history of autism. And I keep wanting to mark places in the book to just kind of interject little, you know, either small things for sure. Nothing's getting rewritten. But I think that this is going to be one of those books that I'll write and immediately think, oh, wow, I wish I'd, you know,
right.
Just because I'm still learning so much about what I'm trying to write my way into understanding.
Yeah.
But that's why I write, you know, to
exactly
in order to understand, not to represent what I used to understand.
Absolutely, me too.
And but it's play and performance, right? The act of writing is play
exactly.
and performance.
Yeah. And you know, I think that landing on that topic as we did after this process we went through, it turned out to be so fortuitous in that this is it's so timely because of the new writings on autism and neurodiversity and all that. So I think that it will really make a contribution besides the fact that I absolutely love the book.
Right. Well, you know, the funny thing is there are these new perspectives emerging all the time, and they're being, but the established conception of autism is so ingrained.
Yes.
I can't remember if I sent this to you, but a professor in my College of Education in educational psychology announced a new course in abnormal psychology with this disorder, that disorder, this deficit, that debilitation. You know, it was everything that I'm trying to help tease apart.
Yeah.
Contest with this book is just so axiomatic to people who've been in this business for a long time and think that people who are different must be disabled or disordered.
Exactly.
And so I'm happy to have this entry into it, but the problem is that all the funded research, and that's the only research that my dean considers to be real research, goes into these pathologizing studies of what's wrong with people.
Right. Well, you know, have you thought about writing something? Because you are a fairly common commentator in what the Atlanta, one or two of the Atlanta papers.
Yeah. It's the one that is a merger of what used to be the two. So the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is really the only big Atlanta paper left, and I do write maybe once a month for them.
Right. So you should think about writing to publicize this book, meaning this alternative way of thinking about this. I know you can't do it now, but at some point.
Yeah, I've thought of it, and the question is, how can I get this across to people in under 1,000 words? And that's, you know, you have really 800 to 1,000 words, and right. It is a... I want to do that. I probably will, and it'll probably be challenging to achieve well in the medium of, you know, the op-ed or the blog.
Exactly, exactly. Well, what it's interesting, the Psychology Today column that I wrote.
Right, that, right.
A friend of mine sent it to a contributor of the All-Stars who's very active in an autism whatever community organization who, because of her son, and she forwarded it to the entire list. So it she's just a parent.
Uh-huh.
So I think that if I did it, I'm sure you could do it so much better for that newspaper. So Peter, could you tell me how you understand, given that most of your scholarly career has been in the area of literacy,
right?
How did you get here? How did you first start? And a secondary question to that is, why do you think that Vygotsky's work in this area has been so neglected? I mean, I wrote about it a long time ago, but not in any depth at all. And I've never, except for you, come across someone else who's, you know, like really done that. So,
yeah, you know who else has done it, though, I've just learned, is Harry Daniels in the UK. Harry's got a book and at least one article that I've got hold of.
Oh, good. Okay.
So Harry's been up to that. And what one thing that you find when you start, you know, really sticking your nose into this thing is that there are other people who've done this writing. There's also the field of critical disability studies, mm-hmm. which I think has very many of the same aims, although from what I can tell is mostly concerned with framing disability more sympathetically with words.
Yeah, I read yours and Mike's paper.
Oh, you did. That's right. That's right.
And I commented on it. Yeah. Yeah. I really was eager to learn more about it. And I also didn't know if Joan Lipkin's article, since that's an area that she kind of tried to get into, or at least had a reader help her with that, I just thought that that paper was a beginning. And, you know, I know you don't have many words, as something Mike said, so I don't know how it's going to come out.
We can't do a big whopper of a paper on this. And Mike originally said that he didn't want to make this a preoccupation. He wanted to kind of make this a one-off paper. But deciding what goes into that is tricky. And I know that you said, well, there's too much on the Frankfurt School here. And it's a tricky thing to satisfy everyone with what you end up putting in the paper, because we've already cut a lot out.
Yeah, I'm sure. So anyway, how did you get into it?
How did I get into it? Well, to go way back, I have absolutely no formal training with Vygotsky, cultural, historical, psychology, or theory. I came out of graduate school with an information processing ed psych background and to look at cognition in the realm of writing research. So how do writers think as they're writing? Mm-hmm. That was what I was looking into, using protocol analysis. So as soon as I got out, though, I was, you know, I just was just seeing more Vygotsky citations, and a guy I was working with at the time gave me a reading list. And I started reading just on my own Vygotsky and getting on the what was then the, you know, Mike's listserv, what's mm-hmm. now XMCA, used to be XLCHC.
Right.
And that's been the most formal training I've ever had. The rest is reading on my own, offering classes where we talked about it. And again, it was all in the realm of either literacy practiced by students, and mainly in the realm of the English class, not the English as a second language class, but the literature composition and language component, domain of the curriculum. And then I became also interested in how teachers learn to teach, because I was a teacher educator in my position in universities. And so I began looking, applying Vygotskian principles to how people learn to teach. And I also, at that point, just started reading more broadly in Vygotsky, because I was using Vygotsky, but I realized I was relying so heavily on thinking and speech, mainly, plus the odd chapter in Mind and Society. I undertook a reading of all the collected works, which I'm not done with. But one of the ones I read, well, I shouldn't get to that yet. So that was the kind of research program that I'd undertaken and had that went from the mid-80s through about 2010. That's a long chunk of time, 25 years or so. But it was really my own acknowledgement of the mental health issues in my own family. And, you know, I'm already getting away from the term mental health, but I always end up saying it when I'm just talking to people, it's an easy term to latch onto. Because of my daughter's Asperger's diagnosis and other, she's got a number of other conditions that are not typical. And I had been acculturated to viewing people like her and then like myself in the sort of medical way that pathologizes difference.
Right.
That's the only thing I'd ever heard. You have a disorder, you have a mental illness, you have a, you're disabled, you know, critical disability studies. It's all just embedded in the language that we use to describe people who function differently, maybe differently functioning individuals. I don't know what you call it. So, and that's, I don't know if you want this whole story, but I was just thinking more and more about the idea that disability is a really cruel word. Disorder and disability are actually cruel terms to apply to people who function differently. And I wrote a review of an article for a journal that Alan Luke was editing. And Alan is a critical theory guy. And someone, the article had used this very conventional way of talking about disorder. And I think it was just it wasn't even central to the article. It was sort of a chance, you know, sort of a peripheral thing to the purpose of the article, because of why would anyone send me a disorder, you know, a mental health article to review at that point in my career? And I just said, if I achieve nothing else with this review, I hope that I can persuade the author to get away from this sort of pathologizing language. I said something like, My family is beginning to address these issues, and I don't think that we're disordered or disabled. I think that we're different. And, you know, usually you send in a review, and you might never even hear back from the editor. You might hear 6 months later, you know, you might get the whole review package. But no one ever writes you back and says, you know, there's something in your review that you need to write about. And that's what Alan did. He wrote, he says, hey, man, you've got to write about this. He said, you can't let it sit. You got to do this. And I thought, well, maybe by writing about it, I'll both be able to come to a better understanding of these things myself, which is how I use writing myself in my own life as a way to explore and to think. And, you know, and very consistent with the notion of play and performance using the tool of writing. And also be able to maybe tell a story that other people would recognize in their own families or in their own friendship circles, and maybe shift a little bit of thinking about the notion of difference as deficit. And so I wrote, I can't remember if I told you this part before, but I originally submitted it to Teachers College Record. There were two reviews. One said, I love this, print it. The other said, this is kind of interesting, but how in the world is this research?
Yeah.
And because TCR is a you know, a hardcore research journal. And so when I was... And the editor, Lynn Corno, was very, I think she just liked it and wanted to do something with it, but she really didn't know what. And so she gave me feedback. She didn't reject it, although she easily could have, because there was a, you know, what the hell is this review? And when I was working on it, I realized that, oh, this is actually a form of narrative inquiry. This falls within the realm of ethnomethodology. Autoethnography. That's what I'm thinking. So it's actually a form of autoethnography where you tell a story that tells more than the story, usually based on life experience. And so when I resubmitted it, I put autoethnography in the title, and then it became research.
Right. That's great. I love that article. That was so exciting to me.
Thank you. So once I wrote that, once I wrote that, I thought, okay, I've written this. And I had relied on, there's a chapter in the 2007 Cambridge Companion to Vygotsky that Mike and I think Harry and maybe Jim Wirch edited. And it was, I think, it was Boris Gindes and either Kazulin or one of the crowd on the defectology chapter. This is another serendipitous thing. I wrote a review of that book for a journal, and the editor told me, aren't there some chapters in here you're not giving any attention to? And one of them was this chapter on defectology, because it was for Reader and Research Quarterly, and I just thought, well, no one in the reading research field is going to care about this. I'm just going to look at the other stuff. And so she pushed me to read that chapter more carefully while I was thinking about these issues in my family, and I thought, wow, there's really something here. Mm-hmm. And so I quoted that in that article, but I thought, I don't have any choice. I finally have to read that damn volume on pathology. And I'd avoided it because of the title for years. I thought, well, I'll read Vygotsky, and this is the last thing I read. I'll save this one till last. I'll read the other five volumes first. And then I started reading it, and I thought, this may be the best thing he ever wrote.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yes.
It's a tremendous book, and no one else had read it. In fact, there's another story, and I can't – you were at the 1994 conference, I remember, in Galitsina.
Galitsina? Where's that? Galitsina,
outside Moscow. It was the
– Oh, yes.
You were at that. I'm almost sure.
Yes. Yes, I just forgot the name of where it was. Yep.
Right. Right. And I don't know if you went on the, I don't think you went on the tour with us after the conference. I don't remember.
No.
I remember Vera being there and some other people.
I was there with young people from the All-Stars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you were on that tour then. So we went to a school of defectology.
Mm.
And at the time, at the time I was still trying to figure out thinking and speech. This is 1994. I was still very early in my reading. And so And most of us were saying, what in the world? Why are we going to a defectology school? And we walked around, and it was new but already falling apart, very Russian. And, now I think, God, I wish I'd paid attention.
What opportunity that was.
And because I just kind of spacewalked through it because I didn't really know what defectology was. I thought it was a stupid name. I thought it was pathologizing even then. And that was, I think, typical. No one had heard of it. No one knew what it was. And part of the problem too was that the people running this bus tour were very autocratic. Mm. And there, at times it just seemed like they were taking us places that they felt like taking us to, whether we wanted to go there or not. So this was, oh God, now we go to the defectology school.
Right.
So, I had heard of it, but I just had never thought that, why would that be something and so it wasn't until it clicked with me that this was a potentially very informative piece of work, and I'm just blown away by how fresh it sounds now. How it was a century ahead of its time.
Yeah.
In a way that I think even his other work doesn't achieve.
No, that is it. And one of the things that is unique about the book that you've put together is how your voice and your framing is continuously there and how you work to make that happen. So it's, edited volumes are usually just a collection of something.
Right.
You know, it was a conference and these people spoke and editors try to bring something to it. But even from the beginning, you and I spoke about that that's not what we wanted to do.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that you have 3 or 4 chapters in the book is fantastic. And framing them. I think it's unique, and I think that I learned so much from it. And I was wondering what are the... Well, there's your learning, like what did you learn? And as you said, you and I are like this, not everyone is that you learn from writing.
Right.
It's a discovery process for you. And but also, do you feel like you've developed in some way?
Oh, there's no doubt, because I had data from my family, but it was not, you know, I never analyzed my never sat down and coded my life or anything like that. So there was a lot of, so I had read a lot, I had thought a lot, I had theorized this well, but I personally have yet to collect any data.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that has come up through this paper that Mike and I are working on, trying to understand the difference between critical disability studies or just disability studies and whatever this is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big difference is that that any critical theory is concerned with power relationships and discourse. And what in all my reading of critical disability studies, their goal is to construct a new discourse surrounding difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very laudable goal. It's a very important one. It's foundational to other ways of proceeding. But there's no plan. It's critical. It's, you know,
right.
Oppressive structures exist, no doubt about that. Things are hegemonic. You know, some of the stuff you read is almost this parade of critical cliches. You know, the hegemony and the oppression and the
right.
emancipation, and you know, they all seem to have about 6 or 7 words that they're obligated to use. And I'm not sure I see it as emancipation. I see it as but before I get to that, we're also both they're concerned with constructing different discursive
mm-hmm.
environments.
Right.
But I think that if you don't also construct different material environments.
Right.
You've created a different way of talking.
Exactly.
Now that's important, but you haven't really materially changed the way people navigate their day.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, Vygotsky was fundamentally concerned with creating new settings that are both discursive and material. And that's what I find, useful. I'm a very practical person. I think it's probably an Asperger's-y way of being. If I can't use it, I don't have much use for it. And so how then do you fashion environments, and and part of that is the attitudinal environment. That's a big part of the Vygotsky's approach, is that
right.
you change how the people who surround you respond to you. If you consider the human company you keep as part of a material environment, that's part of it. But also, you know, you can arrange spaces so that they're more available to people who are what they call neuroatypical or non-normate. You know, there are a lot of new words I learned too.
Yeah.
In the process of this. They more or less mean the same thing. So what you helped me identify people who ran programs. And, you know, those are, I think, great examples of people who are very deliberately trying to construct settings where, you know, people have to go to them, right? You know, you take your kid to Christine's, LaServa's shop, right, to her building, and they do things in that building. It's all set up for that. And then the idea is for that to then have consequences once they walk out. So they're you know, Aaron and Robin Post and all these other people you helped me locate, all construct deliberate sorts of settings that are designed to be, I would call it the sort of social therapeutics that you've advocated, you know, since I've known you and since long before that, right?
Yeah.
So social therapies, they're not you going in and having a counselor pick you apart.
Right.
You know, they're you go and do stuff and often make things, right?
Right.
And that's what I think is what you do. I get really bored just talking about stuff.
Yeah.
That's all you do. And then the more I thought, I realized that I knew people who had done some research with autistic kids, and including someone who'd studied my own daughter when she was a graduate student with me. And anyone can put this together if you've read more than a few of these works. The chapter that Leslie Cook and I did is really about my daughter.
Right.
And what those people had done was found existing communities of practice or existing activity settings or niches, whatever you want to call them, that people could enter without having to go somewhere and be in a formal therapeutic program, social therapeutic program. So it's really nice to realize that there are both people doing this deliberately with a therapeutic intent, and other available places where people who were different could go and find that they fit in.
Yeah.
So with Alicia, my daughter, it was the online anime community. There was the autistic poet that my friend Christine Dawson had studied back when she was a graduate student. And she never, it's funny, that was a pre-dissertation idea that she had that she collected data on. And that's when I met her back then. And it turned out she never published it. And so I said, hey, let's get this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's perfect for what I'm trying to do. I read there's a book that I love, A Life Animated, the Ron Suskind book about his own family, where, and this, I don't think I'm getting off topic here. What I love about that book as much as anything is that they'd go and take the kid and he'd get pathologized by the professionals. And then they bring him home and they just observe him carefully.
Yeah.
You know, they're parents. And they observed him lovingly. And I think that that's a big difference. I'm calling it now a loving ethnography.
Mm.
It's not a term that Suskind uses because he's not a researcher. But what that does is enable you to look not for what's wrong, but what is good. You know, what is healthy about this?
Mm-hmm.
What does what seems to be a disorder achieving for this person? And by living with their son and observing him and wanting him to be happy and live a fulfilled life, the things that they originally thought were weird, they realized what had become the basis for his learning to be social.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can do that by going to a doctor who just has a checklist from, the DSM, who's finding, oh God, he doesn't make eye contact, this kid's screwed. You know, it's just, if you ever read that stuff, if you ever read the kind of funded research that's done in the name of autism, it's heartbreaking because they take these people with so much potential and turn them into these, smoldering heaps of disability.
Yeah.
And I can't even read it. But that's, yeah. And, shucks, there's another chapter back in there that I'm whiffing on. But the idea then was that there are, there's a lot that's available that I don't think people even consider because they're so interested in getting a diagnosis, what's wrong with little Billy, that they don't ask what's right with little Billy. And so, I think that that's what I'm trying to achieve with this, with this volume. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, very well.
Okay, good.
Very well. What would you like, if anything, in addition to what we've been talking about so far, is there anything else you want to say about either about the field, about yourself, about the process of the book, the significance of the book when it comes out, anything at all?
Well, I always, you know, if I write a book, once it's out, I figure, let's see what happens. I'm not much of a book salesman, I'm afraid to say. It's not in my personality.
Right.
I figure the company can do that, or, you know, whatever. So I'm not too big on what I you know, I guess I hope everyone reads it and changes what they think, but I know that's not going to happen. So, you know, I hope that your marketing people put it in at least some people's hands to see that it has value. But what I would follow up with is that I don't like to be the person who preaches without practicing. And so I have to recognize that the only empirical part of what I've been a part of is co-authoring with someone who's very dear to me. So, and that's Leslie. So I've never collected data on this. I've never done any empirical work of my own. And so it turned out that there was an initiative, a funding initiative, and that's how things are work in universities. If it's, you know, people have their noses to the wind and try to pick, you know, sniff out money. But it has to do with, it's some kind of school. Actually, we're going to do this as a summer program. Anyhow, some friends and I have proposed a summer program. Their interest is in kids of usually what are known as at-risk kids, usually from poverty and maybe immigration status, that sort of thing, that's activity-centered, and that I've bundled with them my interest in neurodiversity, as opposed to cultural diversity or social diversity.